This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Each Friday on Cincinnati Edition, we present an in-depth discussion of the developments behind the headlines. Joining us first, our WCPO.com government and political reporter Amanda Seitz and Cincinnati Inquirer investigative reporter James Pilcher. Later in the show, we'll hear from City Beat reporter James McNair, who's been looking into the hiring practices at the Hamilton County Courthouse, and Cincinnati Inquirer sports columnist Paul Dougherty to get his observations on U.S. Bank Arena possibly landing part of the NCAA basketball tournament and how the Reds are doing so far. And you can join us 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. James and Amanda, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
James, let's start with the investigation that you've been doing concerning NKU's men's basketball team. Now, this was a good year for the team. The Norris actually made it to the NKU tournament for the first time since they've been in Division One. But you're saying 2 years ago, things were not so good. Pick it up from there.
We had been hearing issues that had been going on, and this was actually, this came to light as part of an ongoing lawsuit surrounding a sexual assault in a Title IX federal lawsuit in an unrelated case. But in the lawyer's investigation that's leading the suit against that school, they found how the school had handled these things involving at least three or four of the basketball players back in the 2014-2015 season, which was the team's second season in Division One. It turned out to be a pretty crucial pivot point for the team. What came out of it was that there was a pretty sexually charged culture in the locker room, and then that actually led to at least one woman coming forth and saying, hey, things went too far, I was coerced into doing things I didn't want to do. The players were eventually exonerated, but as part of that, the people who handled the investigation sent a warning email to the administrator saying, hey, you have a culture problem in your locker room as this is going on. So all of this is coming to light now because it was part of the lawsuit, and we just found out about it like 3 or 4 months ago. We'd heard about the actual incident. We didn't know what it was back last fall. Well, since then, in January, those documents became available as part of the lawsuit, and we've been tracking down all of the different angles and leads to it.
So you say the players were exonerated. Who exonerated them?
The internal process, the internal panel, the woman never pressed, the woman involved never asked or pressed for criminal charges. But at universities, especially since 2011, the federal government has required universities basically to have a separate internal discipline process. So they went through that investigation. The school investigated and was presented to a panel of three people made up of a faculty member, an administrator, and a student, and they decide whether or not the students were responsible or not responsible. Now, the players in this case, the three players were found not responsible, but again, the facts of the case were kind of muddy, and then that also prompted that email.
Now, you mentioned this is all Title IX related. Can you explain what that means?
Title IX is a law that basically protects protects women's rights on campus. It also there's a different section of it that requires equality for all aspects of schools, especially athletics, for men and women. So you have to devote as many resources to your women's program or have as many women's athletics programs as you do men. But there's a whole other side of it which actually helps protect women on campus from sexual assault and what the processes should be. And this particular lawsuit that all this came out of, the woman, the student, filed a complaint. The male student was found responsible, but he was suspended, but it was kind of like a probationary suspension. So he was allowed to stay on campus, go to class, and that's where the problem started. The woman complained that he was showing up where he shouldn't be, you know, violating her no-contact order, all those kinds of things. And she alleges that the school didn't really do anything. It was, kind of oblivious to her fate. And she asked for it to change and change and change, and then she says it didn't. That led to the lawsuit. And then that's led to all of these other things coming out about how NKU in general has handled sexual assault in the past.
So you said, okay, so the players were exonerated. I didn't quite catch this. I apologize if you said this. Did anybody face any kind of disciplinary action?
Well, the players never lost any playing time. The incident took place January 3rd of 2015. The woman finally filed a complaint in late February, and the team was on the road. The players who were involved never missed any playing time. There were like three or four more games left in the season. I was told that the players did face some off-season suspension from team activities. Now, all of the players involved have either left the team either through graduation or their eligibility is gone. So none of the players that were involved in this are still on the team. But that's the only discipline that I've been able to uncover involved with this. Now, the other thing that did come out of this is that another woman came forward. While she didn't file an official complaint, she told investigators that two of the three players did the same thing to her the previous fall. So, you know, there was at least some evidence or some indication that this was a pattern. And this all came out of this sexually charged atmosphere that, you know, there were several references to what was called teen time, which basically meant that there were certain women, or that there were the guys on the team knew of certain women who were sexually available. And so that led to a whole culture, apparently, at least in the eyes of some of these investigators, that these guys didn't really value people in general and individual rights and things like that.
I thought the team time thing was really interesting. Was that something like that was coordinated, or where was that coming from?
I don't know. It was just, there were several references to it. Even the investigators asked the women about it and used those terms. I think it's just something, just based on my reporting, it's something that the players came up with on their own. It's kind of a term. I asked a couple of the assistant coaches who were on the staff. They said they didn't know anything about it. So I don't know, you know, and the coach at the time, which is a whole other angle to this, the coach at the time he won't talk to me, so has declined comment throughout all of this, so I don't know if he knew anything about it. What was interesting in the timing of this back in 2015 is that right after the end of the season, it was kind of a surprise move. The school fired the coach. His name is Dave Beasold. And yet that firing came on the very same day that the investigators interviewed both the woman who filed the complaint and the other woman that I talked about who said it happened to her back in the fall. So, but the school swears up and down, the ones that will go on record and everybody else have said that all this stuff with the investigation and all that had nothing to do with Beasold's firing, but the timing certainly does raise that question.
James, is anyone alleging that this is as bad as what's happened at other universities? I mean, this is a this has been a universal problem for a lot of college athletes.
Right. But is anybody saying this is? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's okay. Go ahead.
And to be honest, I've been asked. Some people have asked me why write this story now. Well, first of all, we just found out about it. But second of all, it does raise questions about how administrators in general, it's a national story about how college administrators are handling this. And to answer your question, no, that this was not to the extent of, say, Baylor, where the football team was basically sexually assaulting women and nobody was doing anything about it, and even the administrators and the coaches knew about it. And that led to the firing of both the coach and the school president, who was Ken Starr, who's back, you know, did the Clinton administration investigation. There's another investigation going on in Louisville involving the basketball team, where a former assistant coach apparently hired strippers and prostitutes for recruits when they would visit the school. Now, again, the Rick Pitino, the coach, swears he didn't know anything about it or anything, but the NCAA is investigating that pretty heavily. So this stuff is going on all over the place, and how the administration knows about it or handles it is certainly a question. Now, that being said, apart from the assaults, which were handled internally, and it wasn't like they were trying to cover it up, but they did go through the process. Now, they were fine. Some people allege that they did cover up because the players were eventually not found to be responsible. They still went through that process. So, you know, and they had to report it. So, you know, I'm not found to the level of, say, Baylor or Louisville or some of these other schools or even Penn State. You know, when I interviewed Rich Baney, the chairman of the Board of Regents at at NKU, he even said to me, he said, when I first came on the board, I wanted to make sure we had all this locked down and coming on right after the Penn State issues. So, you know, it all kind of has snowballed from there.
So what other responses have you gotten from NKU officials?
None. They have not reached out to me. They had an issue with one of the pictures that was on our online version, but that's been it. They haven't issued any denials or any, you know, follow-up saying we're going to do this, this, or this. Now, I will say that in some of my after some of my stories involving the other lawsuit, they did announce they were doing a top-to-bottom review of their policies and their practices involving sexual assault. So, you know, I know that that is ongoing. I haven't heard exactly how much they're spending on that, but that I do know they were already started to do that. The one thing they did tell me is they did some extra training and sensitivity training for all athletes and coaches in the athletic department following this incident and following that email. You know, whether that's enough, I don't know. But and whether it's enough to satisfy, you know, the critics who've come out of the woodwork about this, I don't know.
What was the picture they took issue with, James, and why did they take issue with it?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
What was the picture they took issue with, and why did they take issue with it?
We had a picture of Coach John Brennan, the current coach, and they said he wasn't on, you know, he wasn't here at the time. They hired him in early April of 2015, so he inherited some of this, but he said, hey, he had nothing to do with this, and didn't think it was fair that he was there was a picture of him on the website. That was all.
Where do things stand with the lawsuit?
It's actually headed to trial as early as next month, so there's been a flurry of motions back and forth. NKU, the biggest one is NKU, has asked the judge, the longest-sitting federal judge in Kentucky, William O. Bertelsmann, who's very well-respected, to recuse himself. And the reason for that is that the law firm who is handling the case for the plaintiff, hired Bertelsmann's grandson. Now, the law is pretty clear that as long as there's a wall of separation and they don't talk about the case, it's not against the law, but NKU is asking in a case of this high visibility and sensitivity that any possible conflict of interest be addressed. So that's being heard right now, but right now the trial is scheduled to go on late next month. Which is interesting because it comes right after Jeff Mearns, the president, is leaving the school to become the president of Ball State in Indiana.
So where do you expect your reporting on this to go, James? Where are you headed from here?
If there's anything that comes out of my reporting in terms of other issues involving the team, either past or present, but obviously following the lawsuit and see what happens, and then if it does go to trial, see what comes out in trial. A lot of what I've reported so far has just come purely out of the motions and the discovery and the depositions that have been done so far. And there have been some pretty interesting and damaging things towards NKU's case involving the former police chief, involving about who knew what when, but it is headed to trial.
We will continue our conversation, and you can join us, 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and we continue our review of local news with WCPO.com government and political reporter Amanda Seitz, Cincinnati Inquirer investigative reporter James Pilcher, and City Beat reporter Jim McNair. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Jim, thank you for joining us this afternoon. We appreciate it.
Good to be here, Mark.
You have been doing some investigation into the hiring practices in Hamilton County government, and it's quite a lengthy and fascinating piece you have at City Beat. Tell us what prompted you to start looking into this. What got you going on this?
I started detecting this last fall when I was looking at some of the elections in Hamilton County and running into just incidental relationships between people in various offices in the courthouse. And so I thought it merited a look. And so I started gathering string. I started gathering names. I got the list of all county employees, a massive list, and looked for matching names and then showed the list to others in both parties and to find known examples of relationships and connections, political connections, business connections, cronyism, it's called. And sure enough, the list started to grow rapidly. And I had a working list that was approaching 100. I had to weed through every one of those names. I had to verify relationships, connections, and ended up going with those that I could definitely verify.
And how many did that turn out to be? You had 100 at one point. Did it stay around 100?
We ended up with 63.
63, okay.
They were primarily in what we would refer to as the courthouse as opposed to county administration or some of the other offices of the county. We're talking here mainly the prosecutor's office. We're talking the clerk of court's office with some incidentals in some of the courts.
And you're talking about the clerk of courts under Tracy Winkler, correct?
Right.
Okay. Because that's since changed control. And I was just wondering, with the new clerk of courts, is this pattern continuing that you can see, or has it changed?
He, in his first 3 months, got rid of, I think, three of Tracy's relatives, and the president of the Delhi Republican Club, and one or two political honcho types, but did hire the son-in-law of the Democratic Party here, Chairman Tim Burke. Now, so it was said that, okay, well, he's continuing it on the other side. That was one instance, but I think it bears a closer look at what he's done otherwise, which is to hire his top deputies from the private sector, from corporate America. And by advertising those jobs far and wide, he got applications from the West Coast and from Northern Ohio. That seems to be a much more normal process in filling high-paying, skilled positions, even in government.
And I believe, too, with the firings that Aftab Pirval has made, he hasn't necessarily replaced everyone, too. So there's been kind of, from his standpoint, this proof that there were people in positions that maybe we didn't need and that we were paying for that we might not have needed either. Because I know
this is James. The other thing that
there's just no telling. I mean, when you've got workplaces in the county that are laden with family members and political patronage hires, can you go by the evaluations of those employees, which should be public records? You know, are those scored up because they are family and friends? What can you go by to actually determine the merit of those employees?
So, well, I know that,
hang on just a second. Jim can't hear you because we have to have him get his headphones on here so he can hear you, James. But hang on just a second, James, and we'll get to you. Go ahead, Jim.
Okay.
You know, this bears an internal review of hiring practices across county offices to determine whether the county and the taxpayers are getting their money's worth with these hires.
Okay, James, go ahead.
Well, I'm just going to say, Aftab, I know that with all of this flurry of activity he's had since he's been elected, I mean, he's actually put himself quite out on the limb politically and under the microscope. So the minute he potentially hires somebody with a possible conflict of interest, you know that the other side's going to howl like crazy. So I know that the Republicans and that the establishment that Jim has written about is really watching this closely, and I've heard through sources that they're just waiting for the other shoe to drop. So it would be interesting to see what actually happens in the next 6 months.
Well, this phenomenon is actually one that has drawn a curious reaction, which was basically no reaction at all. And that,
really?
I think, should be as disturbing as the phenomenon itself, that there are no parties out there, political or otherwise, any change agents, the Charter Party, academics, advocates of good government, who can take this information and say, we need to give this a good look over. This is an unacceptable situation. These office holders are running amok. Who are they accountable to?
Well, and that's part of the problem, right? Because, I mean, you're talking about a lot of elected offices here. So really, you know, the county commissioners, even though it seems like your list swings a little more Republican, and the county commissioners, which lean Democrat now, they don't have control over Joe Dieters, who he hires in his office and what he spends really at the end of the day.
Exactly. And that's the kind of situation that in other cities has led to metro forms of government, charter forms of government, consolidated forms of government, where you've got more of a corporate or a consolidated kind of a hierarchy of accountability and reporting. It's much more efficient. There's a lot less duplication of effort, consolidation of functions. It's why they do it. But Cincinnati, Hamilton County, I think, would be very averse to that. It's too much change.
Too much change in this. Sounds like it's pretty ingrained that this is an entrenched thing.
I'm not from Cincinnati, so I couldn't explain it as well as others. But I think that there would be a lot of people defending the way things are.
Yeah. James and Amanda, what are your thoughts on that as far as why it would be so hard to change this way of thinking?
Well, it's always been difficult in any cities. I mean, this kind of thing, these machines, these establishment, and, you know, we can call it nepotism, we can call it favoritism, whatever. I mean, this has existed in cities for years, and it's always difficult. Look at Chicago or Boston or New York. I mean, even Tammany Hall back in the day. This all goes in cycles, but right now you do have a couple of change engines in AFTAB and others who are trying to shake it up and make it more professional. I know that there's always been an issue in terms of hiring the police or the guards at the courthouse as well. I mean, it goes down to that level is what I've heard. So, you know, you get an organization in a certain momentum, it's always hard to turn the ship, if you will.
Well, and I think, too, going back to how a lot of these are, I think everyone on the list is elected office holders. Is that right, Jim, that these go back to?
Well, at the very top, these are elected office holders. The list consists of people who work for those office holders as well.
Right. And I mean, at the end of the day, they're the only people that they're really beholden to unless they break the law. And even then, it gets a little murky, are voters. And a lot of these people on your list are really, I mean, we're talking about political dynasties here in Hamilton County. They get out the vote. You know, when you talk about Dieters, you know, they're kind of election machines. So if they're the ones getting out the vote, it's difficult to overturn their power.
Well, I mean, you're an interesting example with Dieters, especially. I mean, Joe Dieters has been our Hamilton County prosecutor for almost 20 years, at least a decade and a half. I mean, and the voters know his warts and are willing to deal with that. They know he's part-time. They know he has a conflicts of interest or past conflicts of interest at his own law firm and things like that, but the voters continue to elect him. I think part of that is that, you know, the Democrats haven't really presented a qualified candidate to challenge him, but, you know, that goes back to all the party politics that goes on in Hamilton County, But, you know, there's an example of, well, it's, like you said, it's up to the voters, but eventually, you know, enough has been written. I know Jim has written about it, and I know the Inquirer has written about it, about potential conflicts of interest and other things, that the voters are pretty aware, and they're just deciding they don't care.
Was it difficult to find any of the people on this list, like to pin their last names down to someone that you recognized, or...?
Fortunately, we have public records, and public records laid the trail and verified the connections for me. So,
how hard was it to get? So, did you get a lot of pushback on getting some of those records? Did somebody stall? Did anybody? I know how hard it is to get records out of the prosecutor's office sometimes.
Not at all, James. A lot of this is online. The marriage licenses are online. Obituaries are publicly posted and remain online. Birth records are available through the health department. You've got lawsuits. You've got real estate records. You've got even Facebook and LinkedIn turned out to provide guidance here.
What were some of the reactions from some of these, both in terms of both the employees but also the influencers, if you will, when you presented them this?
You mean before the story ran?
Yeah.
No comment.
Really? Okay.
Does the county have any policy at all about this kind of thing, Jim, that you could find?
The county does not have any kind of prohibitions in place that go beyond state law. It's the state law as enforced by the Ohio Ethics Commission that govern nepotism and favoritism when it comes to awarding contracts and that sort of thing. So I didn't see any greater prohibitions that were enacted at the local level. So what is on the state books is what you've got here.
And how's this jive with what's on the state books? Were you able to determine that?
Well, that everything here is legal. So the hiring of nephews and nieces and uncles and aunts and in-laws is perfectly legal in Ohio. You can hire them till the cows come home.
And to some extent, I mean, that's kind of fair because, if you have a family, again, I hate to keep on using this example, but it's just so obvious. If you have a family like the Dieters, it's a big family. They're very involved in the legal system, all of them. So how would you tell one brother, hey, you can't pursue what you want to do? So it's, I mean, I imagine it's a very tricky law to write.
Well, that's why nepotism laws are in place, to prevent rampant family hiring on the basis of family relationships as opposed to capabilities and merit and qualifications.
Mm-hmm.
Why else would a job be given to somebody other than merit?
So, but you're not seeing the political will to change this in Hamilton County, I take it, from what you've told
Based
us.
On the non-response that I've gotten and the lack of any follow-up in any other media outlets or any other voices through any other outlets, the collective yawn tells me that people are pretty happy with the status quo.
Hmm. So what about changing things at the state level, though, since that's what everybody's following at the county level? They're following state law. What about making those laws a little stricter on nepotism?
It has to be recognized or determined that this is a problem to be dealt with, right, legislatively. Why would it show up on the radar screen of the state legislature if no one here determines that this is something that needs attention?
Did you do any discussion or any look at, what the policies are at some of the other bigger counties in Ohio, like Franklin or Cuyahoga or anything like that?
I didn't look at those county policies. I looked nationally, and I saw the Missouri and Texas nepotism statutes. I was already personally aware of the nepotism statutes in Kentucky counties and was surprised to see that Pike County, Kentucky, where the Hatfields and the McCoys had it out, has a tougher nepotism policy than Hamilton County does and the entire state of Ohio.
Oh.
You can't hire in-laws in Pike County, Kentucky.
So not at all?
Not at all.
Wow.
So, Jim, if people are listening to this and they're thinking, boy, this does bother me. This does upset me. I don't like this. What's their recourse? What can people do about this?
I imagine there's a number of people out there who have applied for jobs in the county and were rebuffed and maybe didn't get an adequate explanation and walked away disappointed, only to maybe to find out later that so-and-so's relative was hired instead. Is there a grievance procedure for this? I imagine that there is, but how far can they go with that? Because there are no policies in these offices. As long as they don't break the law, they can do whatever they want in hiring.
So it sounds like about the only thing you can do is elect people who won't follow this pattern.
That would be a start. I mean, it's the people who put these people in office.
So were people who were more qualified for these positions, did you find any evidence that they were passed over in favor of some?
I did not. These jobs, for the most part, were not posted far and wide for the public and job seekers to pursue. And so I because the job wasn't even posted, people who would have wanted those jobs didn't know that it was available and vacant in the first place.
So where do you head next with your reporting on this? Do you have any plans to follow up on this?
If there's a follow-up, Mark.
Not so sure since nobody's saying anything.
I've kind of, created I've written a 3,000 word story here and put out a massive chart. Now what happens? Well, normally what happens is that there's some sort of an editorial follow up or commentary and talk, or proposals, but the absence of all that makes me wonder about the interest in this subject. People, I think, anecdotally complain about nepotism and favoritism and hiring. But here, when we see that it takes place on such a scale and there's no outcry over it, then it just tells me that maybe this wasn't a news story in the first place. It's just the way things are.
Hmm. Like you say, that's rather disturbing, isn't it? Okay. Yeah. Well, Jim, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure, Mark.
And James, thank you for joining us as well.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Jim McNair, he's with CityBeat, and you can read his story at citybeat.com. And also Cincinnati Inquirer investigative reporter James Pilcher. And we will continue our conversation after this. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. It's our weekly review of local news. I'm Mark Haney, along with WCPO.com government and political reporter Amanda Seitz. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Now, Amanda, you and your colleague Pat LaFleur at WCPO.com, you've been looking into what's stopping the Cincinnati streetcar, and we're talking literally what's stopping the Cincinnati streetcar here. First off, how many stoppages are we talking since this started running?
So we found that since the streetcar has started testing, the city started testing it in July, that it's been stopped for more than 2 minutes 500 times.
500 times?
Yeah. And that's sort of keeps track of what's more than 2 minutes, just because they feel like that's what's most likely to throw the streetcar off schedule. So anything under that is not kept track of. So,
and that's one of the big issues with the streetcar is keeping it running on time. So
yeah.
two minutes is significant if
right.
it happens enough
we
times.
We actually found, based on the information that SORTA gave us, that the average block was 10 minutes. Now, keep in mind, this does include data like when the streetcar has been shut down, like when there was a shooting, for example, downtown, it was shut down for hours. Or like I think one of the other things that stopped it was a fire at Boca Restaurant, for example. So there's been times where it's been closed for hours. So that might sway the data a little bit here. But yeah, we were surprised how long the stops are. And it is a common complaint we hear from council and consumers as well, that it's not running on time. It's a short route to begin with. It needs to be on time to be successful.
So what are the primary causes of this? What's leading to these stoppages?
Yeah, so really a lot of cars block is just stopping on the streetcar tracks. We also found even examples of emergency vehicles, for example, stopped on the tracks. I don't know that there's a lot that they can do about that. But what initially spurred this story was we noticed that Rheingeist, which is an advertiser, a supporter of the streetcar, was catching a lot of flack, really, for being one of the areas that the streetcar is stopped most frequently, or they find vehicles stopped, maybe not stopping the streetcar, but they find them stopped on the tracks.
So beer is causing this, is that?
It comes back to our love of beer, yes, that's the problem here, is we love beer so much that it's stopping the streetcar.
Well, and how often does that happen at Rheingeist?
So we found that actually it's only actually stopped the streetcar like 38 times in February, I believe was the number that we found. Vehicles, so it could be Uber drivers, Lyft drivers, and then even party buses are...
Right, it's not necessarily Rheingeist's fault. It's just people
no,
are stopping in front of it.
It's not their fault at all, but they have so many people wanting to come to the brewery, and there's not a whole ton of parking anyways near the brewery, so people are dropping off their friend, that sort of thing. But we found that in February alone, they found people parked on the track somehow 135 times, which was way more than any other area in the city. There's other problem areas. Areas in the city, but that was infinitely a bigger problem than anywhere else.
What are some of the other problem areas?
Downtown a lot, near the banks. But again, nothing really measures up that much to Rheingeist, really. And it makes sense because the streetcar comes out across the street across the street from Rheingeist, so that's where its actual home is. And then you have Findlay Market there, so there's a lot of activity there.
And has there been any thought of equipping streetcars with maybe a camera so that they come up on a car, they can get a picture of the license plate, that kind of thing.
We did not ask that, but that is a very good thought. I know the city, they are being extremely proactive about this. So a word to the wise, do not stop on streetcar tracks because it's likely you'll be written up. We found that since January, the city has issued 231 citations for people who are blocking the streetcar somehow. And that does not mean you actually have physically blocked the streetcar. That could just mean that you're sitting on the tracks and someone walks up and sees that you're sitting on the tracks and stopped on them. So you have the potential of blocking the streetcar. And so they're like, hey, we are out there writing tickets. It doesn't matter if you've actually thrown the streetcar off schedule. It doesn't matter if you're blocking it. If you are on those tracks, we're writing you a ticket.
How much are the tickets?
Been another point of controversy on council as well, is the tickets are $50. And one sect of council has moved to increase the fine to $100, but it hasn't gained any support. David Mann, one of the city council members that we talked to for this story, he was like, you know, here we fine people $100 if they don't pay their ticket to get on the streetcar, yet when someone actually stops the streetcar from getting anywhere, they only get a $50 fine. So that's been a controversial issue, because everything with the streetcar seems to be a controversial issue, as well as how much we fine people for this. Yeah. But on one hand, you look at, like, Ryan Geist, for example, is being extremely proactive. They're working with the city. They're trying to figure out something. So there might be some thought on council, if people are already trying to be proactive about this issue, why find them more?
Is there any thought to, could the city, could they, if they can document Uber drivers blocking the tracks, can they charge Uber for this?
I don't know who the ticket is written to directly, but I would imagine that it could go to Uber. It would go to an Uber driver, for example. And that was the other thing the city also talked about as well, is that they have reached out to party bus services. They've reached out to Uber. They've reached out to Lyft. So they have been really trying to get this issue resolved.
What are you talking about being proactive? What are some of the other steps they're taking?
So the tickets are a big one. It's just getting out there, writing up the tickets. And again, just reaching out to business owners, trying to tell Uber drivers, hey, you cannot stop on these tracks, that sort of thing. That's what they're trying to get, just that awareness level. And that seems to be one of the biggest issues in general with the streetcar, is just that people are not aware of how it works when they're driving. I've seen myself just people who go into the lane that's a streetcar only lane down near the banks, and they actually drive in that lane even though it's marked off with kind of white sticks. So it's just, I think we're still kind of in that learning curve period with the streetcar, that's for sure.
And is this, you're talking about being in a learning curve, so you look at this as being just growing pains for a new system?
I think so, but I think the city does have to be proactive and kind of look at what can we be doing better here, because if it continues to be a problem, I mean, again, it could keep the streetcar from being successful if it's not running on time. And you think about, you have a 3.5 mile system here. So if it's 5 minutes late, if it's 10 minutes late, people might choose to walk to their location. If it's a mile or two, people might choose to hop on their bike instead of taking the streetcar. So this is funny of an issue as it kind of is. It's also really important to the success of the streetcar. And I think city leaders know that, but you know, we need to get it resolved, kind of thing.
Do I have any word on when the traffic study is going to be released?
I don't have an update on that. I know it's going to be a big deal, though. It's the first time in decades the city has looked at this issue. And the question is how much, you know, it's a study, but how much can be done after, right?
Right. I always wonder, too, why they didn't do this prior to getting this whole system running. Is anybody else asking that question?
I think people have actually, you know, and I can't remember who wrote this article, but I think we've kind of been mocked a little bit by nationwide media for, you know what I mean? They come in and they say, why do you have a streetcar system that's designed on roads that were made in the 1800s, right? So I think a lot of people have raised that question, is that we have this new system designed for really an outdated road system as well in our city.
And what about streetlight timing, Amanda? Has anybody looked at the stoppages that's causing?
We did not look into that, a couple people raised that issue. Now, the streetlights were not included as one of the blockages in our data. This was purely like if someone's on the tracks. But certainly, you know, that's another question, right? I remember Pat saying that there has been some question as far as if we can time the lights better, too, to get the streetcar moving a little better.
So you and Pat have any ideas of what you're going to look at next on this?
I don't know. I know that this will be coming up. I mean, from my point as a politics and government reporter, this is definitely a political issue, right? We can't go a mayor debate or day without seeing, it seems, some talk about the streetcar in this mayoral race. So for us, we're really trying to pin the candidates down on where they stand as far as expanding the streetcar or just in for transportation in general, how they want to see transportation in the county and the city expanded.
Hey, joining us now, we have Cincinnati Inquirer sports columnist Paul Daugherty. And Paul, good afternoon.
How you doing?
Good, thank you. And interesting news this week, U.S. Bank Arena has won a bid to host the NCAA tournament in 2022. What does that mean, winning a bid? My understanding is it's not a sure thing. Is that what that means?
Well, you're awarded a bid for the first weekend of the season, or of the tournament, I'm sorry. As far as I know, that's a pretty solid thing. I think they assume that your arena is up to snuff, or they would not have awarded the bid in the first place. Why? We hear one day that U.S. Bank Arena gets the first two rounds, and then we hear the next day, well, they sort of get the first two rounds as long as the arena has been spruced up. It is a mystery to me. I don't know that edict came from the NCAA. I'm not sure where it came from, actually.
So now we have the owners saying that they're planning on rebuilding, tearing it down and rebuilding it. So, I mean, that's still a big uncertainty, though, isn't it?
I think it's not really an uncertainty. If you're talking about the owners footing the bill for either renovating what's there or building a brand new place, the answer is they absolutely won't do that on their own.
I think it's been really interesting to watch how quickly city and county leaders have put their foot down on this one. And it kind of makes sense because you now have a city that's facing the possibility of a soccer stadium that needs to be built, a basketball arena. And I mean, they have to be thinking to themselves that the Reds and the Bengals are going to come a knocking fairly soon.
They're going to want something at some point.
At the very least within the next 8 years, because that's what the contract stipulates. So I just think it's been interesting to watch them just very clearly be like, no, because they kind of have to in this situation, because it's if you give a mouse a cookie situation, they don't want to start giving out the first cookie to U.S. Bank Arena, it seems like.
Yeah. Well, it's not exactly an unpopular stance, you know. I don't think anybody in this city is lambasting the commissioners or the city because they don't feel like, you know, spending nine figures on helping out-of-town ownership get a new gym, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, these people, whether it's Anschutz Entertainment or Niederlander, have never put a dime into that building, a substantial dime. That building has not been renovated
for 20
years.
How long have they owned that, Paul? How long have they owned
that?
How long have they owned U.S. Bank?
At least that long. It's been that long. The last time the building was renovated was in 1997, and I believe that was done at the behest of the Cyclones owner at the time, Doug Kirchhoffer, and I believe he footed most of the bill himself. These are out-of-town owners who just want to shake us down, and they saw an opportunity to do so with the NCAA tournament as the carrot, and so they're proceeding apace. And I don't think anybody is silly enough to believe that the electorate in this town is up for paying for yet another sports palace.
I think you're totally right on that. The one question, though, that some city and county leaders do have to be asking themselves is, we've lost the RNC partially because we didn't have an arena up to snuff. Now we're looking at maybe losing an NCAA tournament, too. How do we stay competitive? How many things do we lose because we don't have a competitive facility as well? I mean, that's just kind of a problem, too, that they have to be reconciling with themselves.
Well, maybe they can find some deep pockets like they did originally. I believe that the Coliseum, as it was known originally, was built by private people here trying to lure an NHL team. Mm-hmm. You know, if we're so concerned about this, maybe some of the deep pocket, thick wallet people in this town can step up to the plate again. I can tell you with almost complete certainty that adding a 0.25% tax to build an arena or to refurbish the current one is going to be a non-starter.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be a tough sell, isn't it?
I don't think there's any selling to be done here because I don't think anyone wants to try and sell it.
Paul, let's talk about the Reds' early season success so far. You know, despite the fact they've dropped their last two games, they're still leading the National League Central with a 9-7 record. So what are what your thoughts are on the Reds at this point?
I would say enjoy that lead while you can. They started 7-2, and now they're 9-7, and that makes them what 2-5 in the last seven games. You know what? They're not trying to pull the wool over any of our eyes. They've been pretty straightforward about what they're doing, and it's a total remodel. And there's a lot, frankly, to like about this team. If you don't get caught up in wins and losses, even if you're a diehard fan. If you just take this team for what it is, which is basically a very young group trying to find itself and put itself in position to make a bunch of money down the road, and just enjoy it. I mean, I look at a guy like Amir Garrett. He pitched the other day, threw six innings, had 12 strikeouts, and he looked like Johnny Cueto when Cueto made his first start in 2008. Same kind of deal, fearless, command, good velocity, and so on and so forth. This is a guy who could really be a fantastic pitcher here for a long time. And they've got a few guys like that. Because I am not a fan per se. That's not my job. I can look at this a little bit more objectively and not be mad every time they lose a game. I see a team that has some young guys on it that have a chance to be pretty good. And the interesting thing this year is to see how much development they can make. And also the way that Brian Price is using the bullpen is the way everybody should have used the bullpen starting about 25 years ago up until today. And that is not to give a lot of time and spend a lot of expense on a closer. Let everybody pitch. I've said that for years. The closers are overrated, and you need to get away from just putting a guy in the ninth inning, regardless, the way they used to do with Chapman, whom they wasted. And Brian's kind of taken that to heart. And so far, it's paid off. I like that. I think that's interesting. I think if you approach the Reds from that perspective this year, not as a diehard man, I'm really mad they lost tonight fan, but as someone who understands what they're trying to do and also maybe appreciates a few of these guys that right now are opening some eyes, it won't be as terrible a year as you think.
Yeah, is it fair to say this is going to be better, safe to say this is going to be a better year than last year? I mean, last year there were times I could barely even watch them.
Yeah, maybe a little better. Maybe better in different ways. I don't know if their record will be a whole lot better. But I think, like I said, you'll see some guys emerge. I think you'll see a guy like Garrett emerge. You might see the guy starting tomorrow, Cody Reed. He might emerge as a guy maybe 2-3 years down the road. Remember, Cueto, as good as that start was, his first start as a Red, as a rookie, was dominant. But he went 9-14 with an ERA of almost 5. That year. So it doesn't happen overnight. In other words, I guess what I'm saying is they can have a better team, a more promising team this year than last without winning substantially more games.
Hey, Paul, real quick, I'm thinking 82 wins this year. Am I crazy?
Yeah.
I'm just
That's what I like about you.
Dogs.
You are honest.
I'd go about 10 less than that.
Okay. Paul, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
You bet. My pleasure.
And thank you, Amanda.
Thank you.
Cincinnati Inquirer sports columnist Paul Dougherty and WCPO.com government and political reporter Amanda Seitz. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. You can find archives of our programs at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Josh Elstro was the technical director. William White composed the Cincinnati Edition theme music. I'm Mark Haney.